My castaway this week is a designer and entrepreneur. His skill as a businessman is founded on his skill as a craftsman, as well as his abiding belief that people deserve quality in abundance in their everyday lives. He first came to fame with the Habitat store, which introduced British shoppers to the chicken brick and the duvet. His retailing empire grew into a multi-million pound conglomerate called Storehouse, which included Mothercare and British Home stores. But he was to leave that business and Habitat behind him. Nevertheless, his flair for design and his eye for what the rest of us want has kept him in shops and brought him back into restaurants. He now owns 7 and is currently designing another 17. With 3 ex-wives and 5 children, he's said to be a better friend than a husband or father, he's ridden the storms to a point where he's achieved personal equanimity. "I have the ideal life," he says. "Practically everything I do, I really enjoy." He is Sir Terence Conran. And is that in the main work, Terence, practically everything you do?
Yes, it is. I don't play golf. I love drawing, writing, thinking. They are my hobbies.
You are driven by them, your son Jasper said.
Oh, driven is I don't agree at all. I'm not driven. I just enjoy doing it and get a great deal of pleasure and satisfaction from it.
But the work you describe is design, not business. That's the emphasis, isn't it, of what you enjoy doing, designing?
Yes, it's designing, I suppose, to create something new. A new project, to me, is a really thrilling thing.
Do you still get a buzz from it when somebody asks you to design something?
Absolutely. I mean, I suppose it's to do with the fact that when I began my life, nobody asked me to do anything, and I had to...
Still feel flattered.
And so I still feel flattered, and I can never say no.
And do you still get that buzz when you're designing a restaurant, even when you've got 17, as you have at the moment, on the stocks to design?
I sometimes get slightly sweaty hands about the amount that we've got going on at the moment. I mean, I should emphasise that they're not 17 restaurants for us to run. I think 9 of them are projects that we're going to run in the future, and the other 8 are for other people around the world.
How important, though, is money to you in all of this? You've made a lot, you've lost a lot, you've made a lot again. You're now said to be Britain's wealthiest restaurateur, whatever that means. I suppose it means you've got the most seats in your restaurants. But how much is it all about money?
None of it at all is about money. I have never, ever been interested in money for its own sake in my life. I'm interested in doing things, and to do things, of course, you have to have money and make money. So,
but is
it
also
a means to an end?
Is it also about being successful? Is it about the success of Terence Conran?
It's about the success of what I'm involved in, rather than, I think, the personal success.
What I mean by that is your critics have said that, you know, you want to dominate, you want to impose your taste, which has proved enormously successful, but you want to impose that on the public. That's what you enjoy.
Impose is a word that I don't think I can live with, but I want to show people things that they may not have seen before. I mean, after all, people can only buy what they're offered, and what I want to do is offer things in as honest and genuine a way as I can manage.
Offer a design for living, a design for eating, whole style.
Offer things that people didn't know that they might want.
Tell me about your first record.
My first record is from a film that I adore called Some Like It Hot, and it's that wonderful picture of Marilyn Monroe in the railway carriage with Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis in drag supporting her, singing to her ukulele.
I got a fever and inflammation, that's what I got. You turn the heat on me, some like it hot. Look what you started, a conflagration, baby, that's what. Don't let the flame go out, some like it hot.
Marilyn Monroe and Some Like It Hot. Of everything you've done, Terence Conran, I suspect it's Habitat that will go down in history as the great revolution of the 1960s that changed all our lives, brought about by you. The wok, striped aprons, wooden pepper mills, and as I mentioned in the introduction, the duvet and the chicken brick. You don't own it anymore. How sad does that make you?
Not at all. It's owned by IKEA and Ingvar Kamprad, who built IKEA talks to me quite a lot.
And, of course, the interesting thing is that IKEA lives and breathes by the flat pack, which I think I'm right in saying was your invention, wasn't it?
Well, certainly it's something that we started to produce in the early 60s when I was a furniture manufacturer, whether it was something that was absolutely original to me, but I saw the advantage of furniture that was packed flat, easy to take away, change in society, women working, what time could a couple go out and purchase furniture together only at the weekends, and they weren't at home during the week to receive a furniture delivery.
But describe to me where the concept of Habitat came from. I mean, what made you think that we wanted a revolution in our lifestyle, that the time was right?
Well, it came in two directions. First of all, I mentioned I was a furniture manufacturer, and I produced a range of domestic furniture. And we sold this range to retailers around the UK. And when I went round and looked at our furniture in these shops, it was invisible. I mean, it was simply subsumed by a mass of sort of other styles. No retailer had any philosophy at all. And I thought, well, it's never going to succeed under these circumstances. Equally, on the other hand, I'd seen friends of mine like Mary Quant, Poland, Tarfin, Ozzy Clark, the early days of Bieber, frustrated designers putting their ideas directly in front of the public in the way they wanted to put them, because they couldn't get through the brown buyers. And I thought, well, I should be doing the same sort of thing for home furnishing.
So there was, in your approach, an element of that Tesco pile 'em high, sell 'em cheap, was it? Look, here is a mass of stuff, you can have it now.
It wasn't just sort of gross pile it high. It was just having a lot of things, a stocky feel in the shops, not things that were prissily displayed.
You created this shop in the Fulham Road, which was desperately unfashionable at the time, and lo and behold, they came, the great and the good, as well as the ordinary. Is it true that Kingsley Amis courted Elizabeth Jane Howard in the basement?
So I'm told, yes.
And the Beatles came
by.
Oh,
yes, I mean, it was a sort of club.
But did you make a lot of money very quickly?
No, we made a little bit of money, but I think that everybody felt, and certainly I did, that we were onto something new that was going to be successful. Everybody said, oh, of course, it'll never work anywhere else other than swinging Chelsea. And I thought, well, that's rubbish, you know, it'll go in Manchester, it'll go in Birmingham, it'll go in Glasgow. And indeed it did.
Tell me about your second record.
Ah, now this is a record for contemplation. It's absolutely wonderful for when I want to sit down, draw, think, and be creative. Pachelbel's Canon in D.
Part of Pachelbel's Canon in D Major, played by the English concert conducted by Trevor Pinnock. In fact, Terence Conran, you opened your first restaurant, I think, 10 or 11 years before you opened Habitat. You opened the Soup Kitchen in 1953. Is it true that all these tramps turned up on the first night thinking it was a handout?
Absolutely. It was actually the first lunchtime. We opened at lunch. In they all came because, of course, it was near Trafalgar Square, and they thought, oh, a very smart soup kitchen. Indeed it was. So they sat down and ate their soup, and we said, gentlemen, this time it's free. This is our opening party. And we were very lucky that a journalist from the Evening News came by at that moment, and she thought it was such a wonderful story that we got a good write-up.
But again, describe the concept to me, if you will. I mean, what was the soup? Who made it?
Debutants, because they didn't cost any money. A friend and I had this idea of a cafe for impoverished sort of students like ourselves, And I knew nothing, neither of us knew anything about cooking. And I had a girlfriend in Paris at the time, so I went and stayed with her and worked as a washer-up in, and eventually a vegetable boy in a French restaurant to learn something about it. And came back with the idea that soup was the answer because you didn't need a chef. You know, I had this huge stock pot with a Bunsen burner on it bubbling away, made very good stock.
And all these Debs stirring it up.
And, you know, we employed these very nice girls who were extremely pleasant and very pretty. And I suppose the thing that made it successful was the second espresso coffee machine in London. Espresso coffee suddenly sort of took people's imagination and a real cup of coffee. And I suppose for the 50s, it was what marijuana became for the 60s.
And then you moved to the King's Road and opened another restaurant.
Opened the Orrery,
yes.
Yeah.
Was the King's Road fashionable already then? This would have been
55. There were stirrings then. And as I say, Mary Quant, you know, established herself there, and her husband, Alexander, opened a restaurant underneath her shop.
But you were very much in the vanguard of...
Oh, very much. I mean, we were all totally impoverished. Everybody who talks about the 50s and 60s and, you know, what a thrilling time. We were really broke. I mean, I remember going into Mary and Alexander's flat and you couldn't open the door because there was a huge pile of writs behind the door. I mean, they were, you know, everybody was just getting by.
So these days you own seven restaurants, as I said. One of them, Mezzo, seats 700, said to be the biggest in Europe. What are the basic guiding principles? I mean, it still must be good food. Unpretentious, but good.
Good food is the... I mean, why do you go to a restaurant? You go for food.
Well, you go for ambiance as well.
Yes, well, I was going to say, then the service, I think, and then the ambiance. And if you get all three things right... Then you get an opportunity to get that sort of essential buzz of a happy, contented, energetic restaurant.
But pretentiousness is not allowed. I mean, I suspect you're the sort of person who absolutely hates waiting for the flunky to come and pour the wine, you know, and you're not allowed to touch it in the bucket.
It makes me go mad with frustration. And I hate the sort of discreet charm of a lady chapel that, you know, many three-star restaurants think that... I like energy. I like the waiters rushing through with long white aprons and trays above their heads. I like to see the food being cooked, and this is why many of our restaurants have got an open kitchen where you can actually see the energy in the kitchen. I like the whole theatrical performance of it.
Record number three.
Record number three is Allegri's Miserere, and it's appropriate, as it should appear here, because the beginning of a meal in a good restaurant might be a dry martini, and I'm unlikely to get one of those on my desert island. So I've got this bit of music, which is twice as good as a dry martini.
Part of Gregorio Allegri's Miserere, sung by the choir of King's College, Cambridge, the solo treble, Roy Goodman, and they were conducted by Sir David Wilcox. Going back to your beginnings, Terence Conran, were you aware of style as a boy? Did you have an eye at a very young age, do you think?
Well, I honestly don't know. My mother certainly did, and she was very much a sort of guiding light in my life and my sister's life. I remember once sitting down with my sister in India and we were turning over 400 carpets and we chose the same 27. So I thought, this is extraordinary that we both have this identical eye. Mm. And I suppose I must believe in genes.
And you excelled in art at school, I think, and you collected things. What did you collect?
I started off by collecting wildflowers. And then I went on to butterflies and particularly moths, hawk moths, that became my passion, and beetles.
But you also made things. You had a workshop and did carpentry.
Yes, I loved making things and made wooden things. I made metal things. I managed to get a 3.5-inch Myford lathe by selling a model of a boat that I'd made to a local publican, and he exchanged it for the lathe. And later I became absolutely passionate about pottery and built a wood-fired kiln in the garden.
And does all of that talent indicate that you weren't particularly academically bright?
No, I wasn't an academic. I mean, I went to a pre-prep school for Eton, and my mother very intelligently saw that Eton would be exactly the wrong sort of school for me. And I went to Branston, which was absolutely the right sort of school for me.
Which you left at 16 with three school certs and went to art school. But the big turning point, I think, came when you were 18 and you went out to work. What did you do?
I got dropped into a most extraordinary job that paid me £4.10 a week, which was something called the Rayon Design Centre, which was set up by the rayon industry in this country to improve design standards. I was given the job of editing a magazine, being the art director of it, putting on exhibitions. I mean, all the things that I was totally unqualified to do.
But you also design. You design materials and things by that stage.
Oh, I'd been trained as a textile designer, but I equally had had this workshop with Eduardo Palazzi where I started, because I'd had all this craft training when I was at Branson, knew how to weld and, you know, make wooden things. I was making furniture, mainly for myself, but also for friends.
But out of all of that designing experience came the three-legged conical basket chair and matching flower pot, which I think a lot of people remember.
Flower pot.
Well, I thought it was a flower pot in a kind of pointed thing.
If you've got a good idea and, you know, you've got a cone and a tripod, you know, see how many different ways you can use it.
And it got pictured for house and garden, and then the story goes that Picasso bought one of these chairs, is that right?
Not the cone one. He bought another one with sort of two large balls that you put your hands on and a seat made out of rope, which was incredibly thrilling. I mean, to me, you know, to have Picasso buy a chair off you, I mean, it was better than a housekeeping seal of approval.
And you'd have been what then, about 21, 22?
Yes, I guess about that, yeah.
And did you ever hear from him? I mean, did he actually like it? Did he sit in it? Do we know?
Oh, yes. In fact, he bought it because it reminded him of one of his paintings, I'm told. He liked it because, you know, it was his aesthetic.
Next piece of music.
Next bit of music is Django Reinhardt and Nuage, which is Hot Club of France. And this I chose because it reminded me of my time in Paris when I used to go to a wonderful little club and listen to him playing.
Django Reinhardt and Nuage. Let's leap through the years, Terence, because as everyone knows, Habitat grew and grew, and then came the Conran shop, its upmarket sister, which evolved in the 70s, and then you merged with Mothercare in the early 80s. You acquired Richard Shops and then Heels, and then in 1986 you merged with British Home Stores, and the whole conglomerate was called Storehouse, which had a turnover of, I think, in excess of £1 billion and employed 33,000 people, 12th largest retailer in the country. What was the game plan for you? What were you trying to do in amassing all these companies?
Well, all the time they were companies that had problems. Mothercare had a merchandise problem, very well-run company, very good properties, but its merchandise was really horrible. And Selim Zilka, who'd started it, said, I think you should run it because you understand merchandise. And we had a terrific time redesigning the range and made things really good-looking and hugely successful. Same with Richards. It was absolutely collapsed chain of 200 women's fashion stores. Really terrible. And we bought them and revived them.
And what did you want to do with British Home Stores?
They were a successful-ish range of stores, but, I mean, they were going nowhere. They had no philosophy. They were losing ground to Marks and Spencers all the time. And what I wanted to do was to make it something where the products were simply designed, cheerful, well-priced, and we had all the talent and ability in our design side to do this.
The story goes that you introduced a pair of knickers at some board meeting and sort of waved them in the air and said how disgusting they were and that you didn't want to sell them in your shops. Is that right?
Well, obviously, in a project like British Home Stores, there's a huge re-education job to do. And so I'd very frequently take the worst examples of merchandise that I thought, you know, were completely against the philosophy that we'd established and say, how could we possibly sell these, you know, appalling tarts knickers? Because it got the message across. I mean, it offended a lot of buyers, and I certainly didn't make friends at that time amongst many of the staff at BHS. But, of course, one of the problems was that it was a merger rather than a takeover, and so you had to cajole people and persuade them, and it was pretty exhausting and very political.
And in the end, it didn't work for you. You were overcome by the politics, I think, and you were eased out, really, weren't you?
No, I wasn't. No, I eased myself out because I felt that I had set the company on a course, and I wasn't doing the sort of things that I liked doing.
But your critics say that you have this mania for detail. You care about the knickers and the individual bits and pieces that are being sold. But you also have this desire to instruct people as to how they should live, and you can't do both. And they've got a point there.
I don't think, you know, you keep on using these words like instruct. I don't. I offer people something, put it in front of them and show them this as an alternative. You could buy this rather than that.
Your third wife, Caroline, said you were incredibly depressed when the storehouse experience came to an end, that it changed your whole outlook on life. Is she right?
It did depress me, certainly, and it also coincided, of course, with the recession and, you know, problems in the Butler's Wharf development. You know, it was a very, very bad time indeed in England for many people.
And the most miserable time of your life, would you say, looking back?
I think probably, yes. Yes.
Record number five.
Record number five is Here to Cheer Me Up Like Anything, which is Handel's music for the Royal Fireworks. I'm passionate about fireworks, and certainly I don't intend to have a funeral or anything like that. I'm going to leave a very considerable amount of money in my will to have a fantastic firework display and a feast for my friends.
Part of the overture to Handel's Music for the Royal Fireworks, played by the English Baroque soloists, conducted by John Elliott Gardner. Apart from spawning all these businesses, Terence Conran, your name has become almost dynastic. Your son Jasper, obviously, is a very successful fashion designer. You groan.
I groan, yes.
Well, don't you like being head of a dynasty?
No.
Why not?
Well, I don't think in that sort of way. You know, I mean, I really am much more simplistic than that. You know, I don't have empires in mind or dynasties in mind.
But if you name shops after yourself, you know, the Conran shop, I mean, obviously the name is...
It was only meant to be one small shop. That was the trouble.
How many are there now?
There are four at the moment.
Hmm. But tell me about your family, because obviously we have to mention Shirley Conran, your second wife, who of course wrote Superwoman and then Lace, among other novels, and your third wife, Caroline Conran, well-known food writer. They've all... complained about you, I suppose, some with affection and others without. You do sound as if you've been, you know, a pretty poor husband and perhaps a worse father. Do you think there's some truth in that?
Probably, yes. So I'm told from time to time. I love them all, and we all talk together, and we're very friendly together, but they've all divorced me, and therefore, you know, I must be unsatisfactory in all sorts of different ways.
Why do you think you are?
I suppose partially because of the work thing, that my hobby, that, you know, that I'm so devoted to what I'm doing that I do not give enough time to being a good husband.
Or father. Neglect is the word that's cropped up with Jasper, and I think your sister Priscilla has said you were a pretty appalling father.
I don't think any of them would say that I was a terrible father to them. They would just say, maybe we would have liked to have seen more of you than we did.
But these days, you're great friends, it seems. These days, you're a much better father than you were when they were young.
Yes, well, I have perhaps more time now to be a father. I mean, I really was working to pay the gas bills in those days, and the sort of things that I were doing, you know, didn't automatically pay the gas bills.
But do you think, looking back across it, the second two marriages in particular and the children, do you think you could have played it differently?
Oh, yes, and I certainly have regrets about that, but, you know, you can't, sitting on your desert island, you can think about it, but you can't do much about it. I mean, it's happened, so all I can do is do the best that I can at the moment.
Record number six.
Record number six is Mad About the Boy, Noel Card's song, sung here by Gertrude Lawrence, and is actually about my children. It's meant to be a compliment to them that I am mad about them all. Four boys, one girl, and five grandchildren.
Mad about the boy. I know it's stupid to be mad about the boy. I'm so ashamed of it, but must admit the sleepless nights I've had about the boy. On the silver screen, he melts my foolish heart in every single scene.
Gertrude Lawrence and Mad About the Boy. You live in London these days, Terence Conran, without a wife, in a loft near Tower Bridge. Can you describe it to me?
Well, it's a very modern loft. It's a building designed by Michael Hopkins, and it has the huge advantage of being extremely spacious with very little in it. Like the thing I did in my very first house, I tore out all the walls and made a living room, a dining room and a kitchen all in one space. I'd sleep in the corner as well, if I could.
And these days you work with people you like, people who do believe in your philosophy. That's what you want.
It's a very, very, very happy time in my life because I work only with people that I really like, and certainly appear, unless they're terribly good liars, quite to like me. And so there are no politics in it, there are no shareholders to worry about. Certainly there isn't the city there. And we're doing things, all of us, I think, that we're really proud of.
Tell me about being knighted, as you were, by Mrs. Thatcher in the early 80s. How much of a shock was it to you? I think a lifelong non-Tory voter. That's right, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
How much of a shock was it to realise that you were the embodiment of everything that she stood for, really, enterprise and market forces and giving people choices?
It was a considerable shock, and certainly my first reaction was not to accept it, but Caroline said that being a lady would get her to the front of the queue in the local grocery store, so she thought that I probably ought to accept it. And interestingly, when I went and talked to the designers in the business, who I thought, you know, think it was the most Sude's Corner thing to do. They said, no, you should accept it because it is symbolic of design being important.
Even at the risk of being thought, as Margaret Thatcher would think of it, as being one of us.
Well, give Margaret Thatcher her due, which not many people do these days, and I'm the last person to, usually. She understood the importance of design, and I think saw in what I was doing, and certainly in establishing the Design Museum, that it was something that was being done for the good of the country. And, you know, she was always supportive about that sort of thing. She gave us a couple of dinner parties at Downing Street to try and launch the Design Museum and get funds for it.
Seventh piece of music.
Ah, now here you are. This is a bit of music for being on a desert island. And, you know, when your spirits get low, you can listen to Desmond Dekker, and you can get it if you really want it.
You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. But you must try, try and try, try and try. You succeed at last.
Desmond Dekker, and you can get it if you really want it. What next, Terence? You're opening a restaurant in Paris?
Well, we hope to, yes.
And shops where? In Japan?
Yes, we have one in Tokyo at the moment, and then we have one in a rather unlikely place opening this autumn called Fukuoka, and then in Hamburg as well, and with great excitement going back to Manhattan again and doing a shop and restaurant in Manhattan.
So you're building another empire, and this time it's an international one.
Oh, it was always international. I was always believed in the common market, and we had a discussion, I remember, at Habitat Time, should we open a shop in Glasgow? And I said, well, why shouldn't we open in Paris? It's about the same distance as Glasgow, and I think we might do better in Paris than Glasgow. Actually, we opened in both.
And what will your, it's a little bit premature, but what will your epitaph be, do you think? Well, let's say when you disappear to this desert island, you're never to return, unless you're an extremely good swimmer. What do you want people to say about you? He gave us a sense of style, or he rid us of the three-piece suite.
Oh, gosh. Maybe that he demonstrated that were things that were available that we didn't know about, in food, in furniture, in design. You know, I don't intend to have a gravestone.
But if you did, as my producer suggested, perhaps you should say, après moi le duvet.
Oh, well, perhaps. It certainly improved the sex life of people in this country enormously. And think of the millions of hours of bed-making that it's saved people.
Last record.
The last record is part one of Keith Jarrett's wonderful Cologne concert, and I choose this again because I can sit down and work and draw, and it inspires me.
Of Keith Jarrett's Cologne concert. Now, if you could only take one of those eight records, Terence.
I'd probably take that one because it is so fantastic and energetic, and I think it reflects my style.
And your book? You've got the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare there.
Well, I had a great argument between Vile Bodies, which makes me laugh like anything, and H.G. Wells' History of the World, and decided on that because I realized I knew so little about the history of the world, and, you know, here would be an opportunity...
To be sensible.
To be sensible, yeah.
And your luxury.
Well, this was a terrible problem again, because I'm a devoted cigar smoker, so I did think of all the private humidors in Dunhill's. But then I thought, probably, let's be sensible again and have an endless supply of A4 sheets of white paper and an endless supply of 4B pencils.
Terence Conran, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
A pleasure.